Thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here and have a chance to talk about some of my recent work with Shlomo Razemat in what should appear in a paper hopefully very soon. So I'm going to be talking about reducing three-dimensional theories to two dimensions. And let me give some motivation for why this is an interesting problem. So of course, there have been many dualities in different dimensions, and supersymmetric dualities with lots of relations between them. For example, theories can appear as domain walls of other theories, and they're also relations by compactification. A very striking example is the 2, 0 theory, reducing that and deriving lots of interesting dualities in lower dimensions. So I'm going to be looking at a similar problem, but somewhat simpler. So just starting with ordinary supersymmetric gauge theories and reducing them just by one dimension on a circle. But turns out to have some subtleties, and to give a hint why it's not that trivial, let me mention some dualities that I'm going to be talking about. So in 4D, there's this example of a Seiberg duality involving SP gauge groups, which was found by Intrilligator and Puglio. And this is with fundamental flavors, and you can see how the rank of the two gauge groups are related. And there's the usual meson superpotential. In 3D, Aharoni found a very similar looking duality, but with some important differences. First of all, the rank of the gauge group is different. The shift is different. And in addition, there's this monopole superpotential. So specifically, there's an extra chiral field Y, and which couples to the monopole Y tilde by some term Y tilde in the superpotential. And this is necessary in order for this, for example, for the moduli spaces of these theories to agree. So there's these extra complications that come in the three-dimensional version. And then also in two dimensions, more recently, there's a duality found by Hori with the same theory on the first side, but there's this further shift of rank. And I should explain this half. So there's two NF flavors. So NF can be half integer. And in fact, it turns out that 2NF needs to be odd. There is a good reason why Hori wanted to consider theories with 2NF odd, which I'll explain a little bit later. But provided this is true, this dual rank is an integer, and this duality seems to work in two dimensions. So these dualities are clearly related in some way, but it's not by just dimensional reduction. So, and clearly the problem is that these are IR dualities. And so there's a general question that comes up, which is, what does an IR duality in D dimensions imply when you compactify it to D minus one dimensions? The problem is that dimensional reduction and flowing to the infrared, these operations don't commute. So you have to be a little bit more careful. So let's try to study this by placing the theory on a finite circle. Then when you look at scales far below the KK scale, 1 over R, the theory looks effectively D minus one dimensional. And if in addition you take 1 over R to be very small compared to any of the dynamical scales of the problem, for example, say lambda QCD, then what should happen is that as you start flowing towards the infrared in this setup, you'll flow very close to the fixed point, to the IR fixed point, before you start to feel the effects of the circle. And so you're essentially dimensionally reducing the IR fixed point or something arbitrarily close to it. So in this kind of setup, you should expect that the effective description you get in D minus one dimensions is, if you start with an IR dual pair, that you should get a dual pair in lower dimension. But this will give us some effective description, and it would be more interesting to engineer some UV description in D minus one dimensions, which flows to the same fixed point. So this will be the problem we try to study. And just to say it in pictures and introduce some notation. So this is the fact that these operations don't commute. This diagram doesn't close. So if you first dimensionally reduce and then flow, you get some junk that you don't really care about. What we want to do is first flow to the infrared and then reduce. And now we want to engineer some theory in UV which flows to this fixed point. And then if we have an IR duality in d-dimensions, it will imply an IR duality for these t-hat theories in d minus one dimensions. So in addition, although I've sort of suppressed it in this notation, one typically in these theories you have some parameters, background fields that you couple to the theory, things like this, and you should decide as you take the radius to zero how you want to scale these fields and these parameters. And this will turn out to affect the theory that you end up with in an important way. So that's some motivation and the outline of the rest of the talk. First, I'll review some results that we found for reducing 4D theories to 3D. Then I'll make some general comments about the problem of reducing from 3 to 2. And it'll turn out to be very useful to study this problem in the context of supersymmetric partition functions. So I'll introduce those. And then we'll go through a few examples. So last year, in a paper with Shlomo and also Ofer Aharoni and Nadi Seiberg, we studied this problem for theories in four dimensions with n equals 1 supersymmetry. And what you find generically, it depends from case to case, but the generic thing that happens is that when you place these theories on a circle, some instanton effects generate a superpotential in the effective three-dimensional theory at low energies. So the theory you get looks like the naive dimensionally reduced 3D gauge theory, except you have to add in this term, where this field Y is some chiral operator which parametrizes the 3D Coulomb branch in this effective theory. So this is this effective description that we get by putting the theory on a circle, but we want to engineer some UV description. And this can be done in this case by recalling that this chiral operator Y has a description in the UV as a monopole operator, as some defect operator where you remove a point from the spacetime and impose that the gauge field has some flux. And so we want to just say, take the UV, the 3D theory, and just add this superpotential with the monopole operator. Then the claim is that at low energies, this flows to these t-hat theories. And so we can start with a 4D IR dual pair and derive a 3D pair. So for example, if we start with classic SUN-Seiberg duality and we reduce it, then the claim is that these theories in three dimensions with the additional A to Y superpotential are IR dual. That's the first claim. Then a second claim, which goes beyond what I've said so far, but you can show this, is that you can derive another duality where you don't have this A to Y superpotential on one side by turning on by starting with the theory with NF plus 1 flavors and giving one of the flavors a large real mass. And after doing some work, you find that on the first side, this operation basically it takes you to NF, the theory with NF flavors and no superpotential. And if you map this mass in the correct way, on the dual side, you end up with the UNF minus NC theory with flavors and, in addition, in some fields in the determinant representation of U1 and this superpotential, where Y is another singlet and these are some monopole operators. So this is a sort of the 3D version of this SUN-Seiberg duality, and you can check this duality and pass us all the usual checks. Okay, so that was the very brief review of 4D to 3D. So now the next sort of logical thing to do is to start in 3D and reduce to 2D. So let me start by reviewing some of the important properties of these theories. So first of all, the field content of these theories, these are theories with four supercharges. So you can get the field content by dimensionally reducing the fields of n equals 1 in 4D. And so you have chiral multiplets and vector multiplets. And this scalar sigma, this real scalar in the vector multiplet, comes from the fourth component of the gauge field. And this will play an important role in what follows. So a new feature in three dimensions, well, so the action can be written in terms of D terms and F terms, so scalar potential and superpotentials. But an additional thing you can do in special to three dimensions is the Chern-Simons terms, which look like this, supersymmetric Chern-Simons terms. And also, you can turn on real mass deformations. So these are associated to global symmetries. And for a given global symmetry, what you do is couple some background vector multiplet to the symmetry and turn on a constant value m for the scalar sigma in this background vector multiplet. And this will, let's say this field phi has charge 1 under this symmetry, then this will modify the Lagrangian in this way. So it'll looks like a mass term. And in general, the different fields will get masses proportional to their charges under this symmetry. So this is just a special kind of mass you can turn on that's compatible with the supersymmetry. And you can do this same operation not only for flavor symmetries, but also for U1J topological symmetries. So in three dimensions, you have these symmetries which have current star F, which is conserved by the Bianchi identity for F. And when you do the same operation, turn on a scalar for the background vector coupled to this, you just get an Fi term in three dimensions. But the point is that these Fi terms and these masses are really the same thing as far as the three-dimensional theory are concerned. They're just background vector multiplets turned on, coupled to these symmetries. Two dimensions is n equals 2 comma 2 theories are similar. So the field content is again chirals and vectors, where now there's two scalars because eta comes from the reduction of A3. And in addition, you have twisted chiral multiplets, which have the same field content as chirals, except they're related by an automorphism of the 2 comma 2 algebra, which exchanges these two R symmetry factors. So now the actions can be written in terms of D terms, F terms, and twisted F terms. So these correspond to some twisted superpotential, which depends only on twisted chirals. The field strength lives in twisted chiral multiplets. So the scalar of these field strength multiplets is this complex scalar in the gauge multiplet. And twisted masses are very similar to real masses. You turn on this complex scalar in the background gauge multiplets coupled to flavor symmetries in 2D. Fi terms, however, are a little bit different. So Fi terms get complexified and combined with the 2D theta angle, and they live in a background twisted chiral multiplet, and they enter the twisted superpotential in the following way, which leads to this action. Okay, so now we want to connect these. So how do we derive a two-dimensional theory from 3D? So we place a 3D theory on a circle. And for the vector multiplets, as I said, A3 becomes the scalar eta. And so the real mass parameters in the 3D theory get complexified by the holonomy around the circle. And in addition, the Chern-Simons term and Fi terms in 3D contribute to the twisted superpotential of the 2D theory in this kind of way. So this is what happens classically, but when you take into account one-loop effects, you find that the 2D Fi term flows logarithmically in this way. So this is for a U1 gauge theory, and this is the sum of the charges of the chirals of this gauge field. And as you change scale, the Fi term flows in this way. So in order to obtain a well-defined limit in two dimensions, you need to scale the 3D Fi term in this way. You hold R of mu finite, and you scale the 3D Fi term in this way. So this analysis is following a paper by Aganagic et al., which I'll talk about more later. But the net result is that the real mass parameters for ordinary flavor symmetries are held finite in the limit, whereas the real mass parameters for the U1J symmetries get scaled in this funny way. So in order to hold this R finite, it means we have to scale zeta as 1 over R, and we also add this logarithmic shift. So zeta is going to infinity in this limit. But this is a strange thing to do because, as I said, these are just different. Fi terms and real masses are really on the same footing in 3D. They're just background vector multiplets coupled to flavor symmetries. So if you think of the 3D theory as some black box with a bunch of flavor symmetries, and we couple some vector multiplets to it, we seem to have arbitrarily decided to keep some of them finite and scale some of them to infinity. And you would imagine that there's more general things that you might try to do. And indeed, under mirror symmetry, U1J symmetries and flavor symmetries are exchanged, so you would expect, this limit maps on the mirror side to a limit where we take the real masses to be very large. The chirals become very heavy and can be integrated out. And in this paper by Aganadrich et al., they showed that the twisted superpotential you get by integrating them out gives you exactly the Landau-Ginzburg model for the Hori-Waffa mirror dual of these theories. So what I'm going to do for the rest of the talk is to try to understand, reproduce this kind of an argument in a more general setup in three dimensions. But to do that, it's going to be tricky to do it without simplifying the problem somewhat. So we're going to study in a simpler setup. We're going to study supersymmetric partition functions and how these limits behave for these partition functions. So next I'm going to review partition functions. Are there any questions so far? Okay. So we're going to study supersymmetric partition functions of these on compact manifolds M, and these have been a very important and useful tool the last few years for studying these supersymmetric theories. In many cases, you can compute these partition functions exactly by localization. So the path integral localizes to some finite space of BPS field configurations. So then we need to just integrate over this finite subspace instead of doing the full path integral. In addition to the dynamical fields localizing to BPS configurations, we can also turn on fixed backgrounds for the fixed BPS configurations for background fields, so schematically the partition function looks like this. There's some BPS, this labels configurations for backgrounds. For example, if you have global symmetries, you can couple background vector multiplets, and so this index would run over the global symmetries. And so the partition function is a function of these backgrounds, and it's given by an integral over the configurations for the dynamical fields. In addition to these mu a's, it also depends on some geometric parameters of the manifold, but typically only on a small subset. There's most of the deformations of the metric of M are Q exact, as shown by these people. And an important property of these manifolds is that they're RG invariant, so they're a powerful test of IR dualities. And that's what we're going to use them for here. So the cases we're going to study are where M is a sphere or a sphere times S1. And this partition function in a sphere times S1 is also called the supersymmetric index. It turns out to depend on tau, which is some dimensionless radius of the S1, so something like the radius of the S1 divided by some characteristic size of the sphere. And the index depends on tau in such a way that as you take tau to zero, you recover the sphere partition function of the dimensionally reduced theory. And to be precise, using this notation I introduced earlier, you should expect to get the partition function of this t-hat theory, because these are RG invariant, so you could equivalently do the problem in the IR, and then you'd have IR appearing on both sides, and so the UV theory you would expect to appear here is this tau hat or T hat. And in addition, there can be some overall factor. So this is sort of the leading behavior in the small tau limit. And there can be some overall divergent factor which appears. And this was studied, for example, by these people in four dimensions. It was shown to be related to anomalies. In three dimensions, it's not known what it tells you, but I think that's an interesting problem. But in any case, it's something that you can easily compute. And for dual theories, it has to agree, just because the theories agree as a function of tau. So if we have an IR dual pair in D dimensions, this kind of relation implies the IR identity of the sphere partition functions of these lower dimensional theories. So this is just a statement at the level of the partition functions of what I said at the beginning of the talk. And as I mentioned there, you have to also scale these background fields. You choose how to scale them. And so in the partition function, we're going to have to choose how to scale these parameters mu a as we take tau goes to zero. And this is going to affect what theory we land on in three dimensions, in two dimensions. Now, the reason, well, one thing we'd like to do with this procedure is reconstruct this t hat theory. This is our ultimate goal. And to do that, you need to be able to write the partition function appearing here in the form, in this kind of a form, as an integral, so that you can read off the UV ingredients that go into it. But it's typically a tricky problem to take a limit of an integral expression and rewrite it as an integral. You have to be very careful with how you scale the integration variables. So to give some very silly toy examples, if you take some limit of this integral as tau goes to zero, if you just were very naive and took it inside the integral, you wouldn't get something that makes much sense. But if you first rescale the variables, then you can better understand the leading behavior at small tau. And similarly, so this is an example where the contributions to the integral are spreading out as tau goes to zero, but you can also have them running off to infinity. And so the point is to follow the dominant contributions to these integrals in such a way that we can rewrite the limit as a partition function. And then once we understand how we need to scale the variables appearing in the partition function, we can conjecture that this is the same scaling that you have to do for the fields in the full theory. So we find some rescaling of these gauge variables in the integral, and we conjecture that this is also how you have to scale the gauge field. Okay, so next I need to review the specific partition functions that we're going to be using. So first, the 3D supersymmetric index. So this is the partition function S2 times S1, and it's the BPS configurations that it localizes to are these configurations for the vector multiplet. So the gauge field has some flux on the S2 labeled by an integer m, and the scalar sigma is also set to m, m over 2. And in addition, you can turn on an arbitrary value for A3, the component of the gauge field along the circle. And so the configurations are labeled by this integer m and this holonomy, which I call z, little z, which is e to the I tau big z. And I write them in boldface just to distinguish them from the 2D parameters, which will appear in a moment. So the index of a chiral multiplet in a background of this U1 gauge field configuration is given by this explicit expression, which I've just written down to show it can be, it has a explicit form. It's not that illuminating to stare at it, but it can be computed. And here delta is the R charge of the chiral. And Q is how the radius tau enters. So Q is e to the minus tau. And then for a general gauge theory, you just build up these ingredients. You take a product for all the chiral multiplets in the theory, and there's some Chern-Simons contribution, which I'll write down in an example in a moment. And then you integrate this over the gauge group. So the holonomies run over the maximal torus, and the magnetic fluxes run over the charge lattice. For S2, looks very similar. So the gauge field again reduces to the BPS configurations are these monopoles with fluxes on the S2. Sigma is related to M again, and now the scalar eta is arbitrary real number. And the partition function of a chiral multiplet in this background is given by a ratio of gamma functions. And in addition, it also localizes to constant configurations of twisted chiral multiplets, and their contribution to the action or to the partition function is just through this classical twisted superpotential contribution. So now, then, putting this together, the partition function of a general gauge theory is given by this kind of expression, very similar to 3D, where there's also this contribution from the twisted chirals. And this is the contribution of the FI term and theta angle. So now I want to rerun this argument I gave before of how what I call the standard limit of how you need to reduce 3D gauge theory in order to land on a 2D gauge theory. And the basic relation that we use between these partition functions is that as you scale the... So if I go back, remember that when I did the standard limit, I held finite sigma and the holonomy, A3. So I need to hold Z and M finite as I take the limit. Holding Z finite means Z, little z scales to 1. And so this is the limit I take. I scale Z and M in this way as I send tau to 0. And what you find is just the partition function of a chiral multiplet in 2D up to some divergent factor. Okay, so now we want to use this to reduce a 3D gauge theory. So here I've written a general 3D U1 gauge theory. And here is the contribution. This is the Chern-Simons level K. And this is how the U1J field couples. So W and N are parameters for the U1J symmetry. And we want to recover the partition function of its dimensional reduction. So I've written that here. And so you can see by just comparing these expressions and using this formula that in order to relate these, we need to scale the parameters in this way. So for the flavor symmetries, we take the same limit here. We hold the sigma and A3 finite. And for the UNJ symmetries, for the fugacities for the UNJ symmetry, we have to scale them as 1 over tau. So specifically, the holonomy Z is going to scale as 1 over tau. So that the A3 scales as 1 over tau, so the holonomy is finite, and it will turn out to be related to the theta angle in 2D. And the flux, N, is also scaled as 1 over tau. And in addition, you have to add this logarithmic shift in order to cancel this piece here. So to cancel the contribution of this divergent prefactor that depends on the gauge field. But this is exactly the same limit that we found earlier. We needed to scale the 3D FI term in this kind of a way, as 1 over R and with a logarithmic shift in order to land on the 2D theory. So we've just reproduced that fact, the level of these parameters in the 3D index. And so when you go through this, you find that this index reduces to the index of the 2D gauge theory up to this divergent factor. And there's a star here because this... So I didn't actually argue for you that this is the correct scaling, right? I'm allowed to pick this as I please. These are just the parameters of the going into the index, so I can scale them however I want. But then there's a unique correct way to scale the integration variables in order to be able to exchange the limit and the integral. So I've claimed that this is the correct way to do it, but that needs to be checked. And in fact, in some cases, that's not true. A related point is that, so this Chern-Simons level here has been completely washed away in this limit. Because I'm keeping Z finite, and Z goes to 1 and M is finite, so this just goes to 1. It doesn't contribute in 2D, which is a little bit strange because the Chern-Simons term is very important effects in the dynamics in 3D, so it's surprising that it would not matter at all in the 2D limit. And indeed, one way it can contribute is that it will cause this argument to go wrong. It will cause contributions to be from far away in this sum over M to become important and force you to rescale the variables. Okay, so now I want to turn to a few examples. So let's first of all reproduce this argument of Akinnajich et al. Reducing 3D mirror symmetry to 2D mirror symmetry at the level of the index. So I'll start with, I'll do the simplest example of 3D mirror symmetry, which is a duality between a free chiral multiplet and U1 gauge theory with a single charged chiral and Chern-Simons level 1/2. So here are the indices of these two theories. And so now we want to take a limit of these. And so first of all, let's take the standard limit of the gauge theory, which I just reviewed. That means we need to scale these U and J parameters in this way. And when we do this, we find that the index of this theory just reduces to the partition function of the 2D U1 gauge theory with one chiral up to this divergent factor. But now, if we do that limit on the other side, we're taking a limit where the chiral becomes very massive. And so we have to take this limit of the index, where the flux is diverging and the holonomy is held finite. So this is very different from the limit we took earlier, but this can also be computed. And you find that the leading behavior for small tau is this kind of piece. So one important point is that the divergence agrees with the other side, which had to happen because these indices are dual or are equal. But in the computation, it's not obvious that that should happen. And the finite piece is this simple exponential factor. So we can to understand physically what happens or what this means, we can compare it to the predictions of Hori-Waffa mirror symmetry. And so recall that if we have a U1 gauge theory with a charged chiral, they tell us to T-dualize that chiral into a twisted chiral Y, which couples by this kind of a twisted superpotential to the gauge field. And in this simple case, sigma just acts as a Lagrange multiplier, which sets Y equal to T and just gives us some classical contribution e to the minus t, which is exactly what we reproduce here. Sorry, this should be minus e to the t. And this piece here, this is related to the R charge. So let me just say that if you want to compute the S2 partition function of the at the superconformal point, the R charge of the chirals there is set to zero, so this piece goes away. So there are some words you can say when for general. So if you were to add a superpotential to this theory, then that would fix the R charge to be something else, and then this contributes to let me get to that in the next slide. So there's another limit we can take, which is where we take the standard limit for the free chiral. So that means we keep the mass of the free chiral finite. So we scale W and N in this way. And so the free chiral reduces in the usual way. But on the gauge side, what you find is that in order to be able to commute the limit and the integral, you need to scale the gauge variables in this way. So in particular, M gets scaled as 1 over tau and can be approximated by a continuous variable. So for finite tau, it's an integer, but in the limit, you can approximate it in this by this real number alpha. And Z is written like this, so beta is some periodic variable. And then if you take the leading behavior of the integrand, and you find this kind of expression. So now the integral and sum over Z and M become this integral over alpha and beta and of this expression. So again, we can compare to the prediction of Hori-Waffa mirror symmetry. And in this case, the dual of a free chiral is just this a Landau-Ginzburg model with Y, the field Y, which is related to alpha plus I beta, and which is related to which came from the naive reduction of the gauge field sigma by rescaling it in this way. And this twisted superpotential is this, and this is exactly what we recovered here. Let me comment on this R charge. So it turns out if you add a superpotential, the way that enters the Hori-Waffa dual description is by changing the basic fields that you use from y to something like e to the minus delta y. And so this this factor can be thought of as, can be absorbed into this integration measure as this change of variables. This was shown by Gomez and Lee. And they also check this duality directly. In fact, in this case, it's a relatively simple identity. It's some Fourier transform of these gamma functions. So this can, this equality of these Hoare-Waffe dual pairs can just be shown analytically. But we wanted to reproduce it by this argument of reduction of the index from three dimensions, mirroring the argument of Agonesh et al. So one side comment I should make, just in practice, it's very difficult to find the correct scaling of the gauge variables in these, even in these simple examples, and especially in more complicated non-abelian examples. So one trick that we use is that if we have a dual pair, we can try to scale the gauge variables in some arbitrary way, and then we can compute what the divergent prefactor is when we scale them in this way. And if we have a dual pair, we've seen that the prefactor has to be equal for the two sides. So if we find some scaling that makes these divergent prefactors the same, which is not completely trivial. I mean, these prefactors can be somewhat complicated functions of, I mean, not complicated, but they're functions of all the parameters of the theory, and it's non-trivial that they would match. So this is a strong check that we found the correct scaling. And then you can further check that we found it, the correct scaling, by just numerically computing the S2 partition functions we obtain and seeing that they agree. Okay, so since we successfully reproduced this argument of Agonesh et al., let's try to apply this to some new examples and see what we find. So first I'll consider the duality appetizer. So this is a duality between an SU2 theory level 1/2 with an adjoint chiral, which is dual to a free chiral. And so now we take the standard limit for the chiral. We just take the limit with its mass being held finite. And we need to decide what to do on the SU2 side. And it turns out that the appropriate way to scale the gauge variables in the index is as tau to the 1/2, as tau to the minus 1/2. So you hold this combination finite. So this is different than what we saw in the last example. And you can understand it by looking at this effective superpotential with the, if you have only a Chern-Simons term and no Fi term, because it's SU, so there's no Fi term, then this is the only twisted superpotential you generate. And in order to make this of order 1, you have to scale sigma as r to the minus 1/2. And this is what you find in the index computation as well. And so after taking the limit with this, this is taking sigma to be very large in the limit, and this causes the charged fields to be very heavy. And you can integrate them out and compute the twisted superpotential they generate. And what you find is the S2 matrix model of some Landau-Ginzburg model coupled to a chiral multiplet. And then you can just apply Hoare-Waffe duality to the Landau-Ginzburg model, and it turns out everything simplifies, and you just end up with two chirals, x and y, interacting by a xy squared superpotential. So then the final statement is that starting from the duality appetizer in 3D, we reduce to a free chiral. The free chiral reduces to a free chiral, and this SU2 theory reduces to this xy squared model. And the S2 partition functions match. It's sort of a trivial statement. It's just some identity of one gamma function equals a product of two gamma functions. But actually, there's some physics in this duality. So this is actually a special case of another duality of Hoare. So he has a duality between SO and O and a Seiberg-like duality. And if you take N to equal to NF equal to 1, then on this side, this is just SO1, just trivial with one flavor. So this is just a free chiral. And on this side, you have one flavor and a meson, and the meson superpotential is exactly this XY squared. So you get almost what we found, except that this is O1, which is Z2. So it's actually a Z2 orbifold of the XY squared theory. And so this is a true duality. The free chiral is actually dual to a Z2 orbifold of this XY squared theory. And what happened Here, in our reduction, we didn't see this because the S2 matrix model is not sensitive to this orbit folding because it doesn't have any one cycles, so it can't see the twist fields. But if you compute the elliptic genus of these theories, you find that they only agree if you correctly account for this orbit fold. So this is just a lesson, is that the S2, obtaining this identity of the S2 matrix models is sort of not in a very strong test. You have to do more tests in, for example, checking the elliptic genus. And then this led us to this, to understanding what the correct duality was. Another example we can do, we can start with UN Aharoni duality in three dimensions. So this is a duality between UNC gauge theory with NF fundamentals and UNF minus NC. So again, it's a Seiberg-like duality. And with this monopole superpotential. So there's chiral fields V plus and V minus, which couple to monopoles. And as a result, these V plus and V minus are charged under the U1J symmetry because the monopoles are charged under the U1J symmetry. So let's try to reduce this theory. We take the standard limit, which recall means all the flavor symmetries are held, their real masses are held finite, and the U1J real mass is taken very large. But because these V plus minus fields are charged under U1J, they become very heavy in this limit. And then they can just be integrated out, and they generate just some background twisted superpotential. And this actually recovers a duality that was discovered very recently by Benigni and collaborators, where they found these these theories in two dimensions are dual, provided one correctly accounts for this background action. So this is sort of analogous to contact terms in three dimensions that one has to add to match partition functions. And it sort of seems like a trivial, it's just some extra background action, but if you were to promote some of these fields, say gauge this is some background gauge field, if you were to gauge it, then this would become very important. Okay. So the next example I want to talk about is the SP duality that I mentioned at the very beginning. So this is a duality. So we want to reproduce the Hori's SP duality and understand this shift of rank. And to do that, we need to start with this slightly different duality in three dimensions than the one I mentioned earlier, where we also have a Chern-Simons term. And the Chern-Simons term enters the dual side by the shift of the rank of the gauge group. And additionally, there is no monopole superpotential. So starting from this duality, you can try to do the reduction. And this, as usual, the first thing we should try is just to take the standard limit on both sides and see if it works, and specifically to see if these divergent prefactors match. And it turns out that they only match when k equals a half. So what this means is that for k equals a half, it's correct to take this scaling, this standard scaling for the gauge variables. For k different than a half, there's some other scaling that you need to do. And in fact, we can find that in different examples. It turns out that you need to scale some of the gauge parameters to be very large, and Higgs is the gauge group down to some subgroup, and you can reproduce other dualities in two dimensions. But the simplest case is k equals a half, where the standard limit works, and then you just reproduce this duality of Hori because you get the correct shift of rank, and the Chern-Simons term, as I said before, is just washed away in the standard limit. So as I mentioned earlier, Hori only considered these dualities with an odd number of chiral multiplets, and the reason for this was because these are so-called regular theories, which means that their Coulomb branch is lifted by quantum effects. So you can just do a calculation and see that the twisted superpotential you generate far out in the Coulomb branch lifts the Coulomb branch exactly when NF is odd. And so you don't have to worry about the non-compact moduli space that you would get if you have a SP theory, which would have some non-compact Coulomb branch. So in that sense, these theories are a little bit better behaved. But you can nevertheless try to say some things about irregular theories. So in this is the last example I'll do, and this is somewhat speculative, but try to derive an example of an irregular duality in two dimensions. So we start from this duality in three dimensions, just SP2 with four fundamental chirals, which is dual to a bunch of chirals, so meson chirals in singlet Y with this superpotential. And again, when you reduce the index, you find that the divergence scalings match with the standard reduction on both sides. And so the net result is that the naive reductions of these theories in two dimensions are just equal. The S2 partition functions are equal. So this seems nice. It seems like this might be some duality. But the first extra check that you should do, the elliptic genus, you do it and it turns out it doesn't work. These don't agree. So there's a few ways to deal with this. First of all, the simplest is just this duality is just wrong. That could be, but that first of all, you'd have the fact that the S2 matrix models agree is some non-trivial statement that I think needs some explanation. And in addition, if maybe we're doing something slightly wrong, but there should be some way of reducing this duality to two dimensions and getting something. So maybe more likely is that this duality needs some small modification in order to work. And we saw a similar thing happen with the duality appetizer example. When we reduced that, we found the duality that we read off from the S2 matrix model was not true. But with some modification, this orbifolding, we found the correct duality. So maybe there's some similar thing here that you need to do, maybe some orbifolding, although so far we haven't found the correct thing to do. And you can generate, this is the simplest example, but you can generate many similar S2 identities for SUN theories, which are irregular. So you generate, in fact, the SU three-dimensional duality I mentioned earlier, you can just reduce both sides of that, and it turns out to give S2 identities. And so these are on the same footing. They seem to work on S2, but there seems to be something subtly wrong with them. And it could be also related to the non-compactness of the moduli spaces. Another possibility is that the elliptic genus for these theories with non-compact moduli spaces needs to be understood more carefully. And there's recent work of Harvey and collaborators where they studied these theories with non-compact moduli spaces and found these mock modular forms. And so maybe that story is also relevant here. Okay, so to summarize, so we've tried to reduce dualities, IR dualities, and found several subtleties. In particular, the theory you obtain depends on how you scale the background parameters. We saw that taking the same dual pair in three dimensions and scaling the parameters in different ways, we can get different dualities in two dimensions. And in addition, it's a difficult problem to understand how the parameters of the integral need to be rescaled in order to commute the limits. And this translates to the physical problem of how do you rescale the parameters in the full theory in order to get a non-singular description in two dimensions. So this is a difficult problem, but the index can help answer this. And in the process of doing this, we re-derived some evidence for known S2, known two-dimensional dualities, and found some evidence for new ones, but there's still puzzles that need to be understood. So just a few directions could go from here. So obviously, one thing is to understand better exactly what's happening with these scalings. Why are these rescalings necessary? The index tells us what they are, but physically, it still need to be explained. Of course, there's lots of other dualities one can look at in three dimensions and try to reduce and maybe derive some new dualities in two dimensions. So, for example, non-abelian mirror symmetry. and dualities derived from class S in four dimensions. And that also leads one to consider compactification by more than one dimension. So rather than just compactifying on a circle, one can compactify on, say, a Riemann surface, and there you have a much richer structure because you should expect the theory you obtain to depend on the topology. Maybe you can turn on some fluxes on this surface, and so there should be a much more rich story to tell in this case. And indeed, there are very recently tools that one can use, partition functions, on a very wide range of manifolds, including products of Riemann surfaces. And so that's a natural place to try to study this problem. And with that, I'll stop there. Thanks.
In the case of non-compact modular states, I mean, don't you have to even define what you mean by the ground state?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a question of what things you would expect to match. You could expect some observables to match, maybe not all of them. So you have to define. It's a trickier setup. So it's not clear what the best you could hope for is, but. For example, S2 partition functions seem like they have a good chance of matching. The elliptic genus matches in at least some cases. For example, this duality I mentioned earlier, this has a free chiral on one side. So this is really a duality with non-compact moduli space. But nevertheless, the elliptic genus matches. So yeah, I agree it's a subtle question, but I think there should be some true statements you can make in these cases.
If not, best thanks to you.